You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Well, we're going to be fearless, focused, calm, decisive, whatever those elements are. And make sure that everybody on board, that gets onboarded, understands, okay, when you step into this space with this athlete, this is who we are. Right? So.
Hey guys, you're now listening to the Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy.
Right guys, welcome back to the Coaches Network. My name's Coach Yas, and today I've got a very special guest with me. I've got PGA 2019 Golf Coach of the Year, Kevin Kirk.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate you inviting me on, and it's just an honor to be with you. So thank you so much for the invite.
Likewise, and I thank you. The pleasure is going to be all mine, I'm sure. Kev, just before we get started, obviously I touched on there that, you know, you're PGA Golf Coach of the Year last year. For those that aren't familiar, and you know, that if that doesn't give enough a picture of what you do exactly, do you mind talking a little about who you are and what you do, and I guess in brief how you got to where you got to right now?
Yeah, I'm actually a PGA kind of a master professional. So I've been coaching golf for about the last 30 years, I would say, pretty consistently. And my title here at the place I work is called, I'm the director of instruction at the Woodlands Country Club. And so I oversee the development of the programming and coach education. And then I also spend quite a bit of time with kind of our high performance group. And so that golf is up most of my time. I've came into this golf instruction space as a failed player. I was really an accomplished amateur and was all American in college and played for professionally for 6 years after I got out of school. I just tapped out. I just couldn't get myself organized to be able to kind of play well enough to, you know, in my mind, justify continuing to play. So I stopped after about 6 years and took a year off just to try to decide what direction I wanted to kind of go with my life. And after a year of contemplation and decided that was probably the coaching pathway was something that I could move into. So I moved into that and I've been doing that for the last 30 years and it's just been a joy for me. So.
Excellent. Curious to know that obviously you moved into that coaching space So like yourself, I mean, I'm from the coaching world, albeit a different sport. And as we go through the, I guess, the journey as coaches, we all start to develop our own ideas, our own ways of working and our philosophies and, you know, things that we're kind of fans of and things we kind of steer away from. So just a little bit more about yourself and your philosophy. You know, how would you describe that?
I would consider myself, you know, currently a kind of a developmental coach. I believe in, you know, pursuing athlete, long-term athlete development principles. Movement-based coach. I love to kind of watch movement and high-quality movement. So as I think things through from a coaching perspective, it's really in those two channels that I really hang out the most of my time. So I've spent a lot of time studying anatomy and physiology and biomechanics and, you know, all the movement skill stuff. And I've also spent a good portion of my time trying to just work through, you know, what does true development look like? So how do you take an athlete and move them down some sort of developmental pathway? So it took me a while to get there. From the time I stopped playing, I had some good coaching. My technical skills were good. My golf IQ was high when I started as a coach. So it wasn't like I was starting from a bad spot. And I had a chance to really go just chase things down and pursue things that were just, you know, my curiosity basically kind of drug me around for a long time. In the early days when I was first getting started, there wasn't really much tangible sports science that you could really hang a hat on. I was really trying to pursue some of those things. So I was trying to understand golf in my sport, maybe from a little more of a scientific and more objective perspective, because at that point in time, there was very, very little objectivity in our sport. So I spent about the better part of 10 years or so just trying to turn over rocks to help myself upskill myself in objectivity. So, you know, trying to understand the geometry of what was happening and the physics and the biomechanics and the neurosciences and anatomy and physiology and some hard sciences that would actually, that were tangible, that I could actually, you know, start measuring things and quantifying things. And that was back in those days, nobody was doing any of that. So it was just, and it was just because I was out of a frustration as a player. It only made sense that I've got to try something. You know, I've done enough of this subjective coaching and been around enough subjectivity. I needed to develop some more objective tools. And it's funny, you kind of go full circle. And once you kind of gain a certain level of objectivity, you realize that there's a fair amount of subjectivity. So there's, you know, the intuition and you know, instincts and other things that you have to, you know, kind of the people skills that you have to develop to be a good coach. So it's, I fancy myself as kind of a Kaizen guy. I'm just kind of, you know, continually improving and trying to kind of make myself a little bit better each day. And I've been blessed to be around some incredible other coaches, service providers, athletes, and all of them have been great teachers to me. So, you know, as I sit here, I'm probably behind you, probably the luckiest guy on the planet.
Right. Now, listen, thank you for that. It's quite in depth. And I think, you know, the first thing to kind of sort of talk about there, you know, you talked there about paying attention to the, you know, the biomechanics and the movements. And now, really, in some ways, would you agree that you said these are quite technical aspects of the sport?
Yeah, absolutely.
Very much in the way that you work, you kind of, as much as your attention is on that, you know, you're a lot of your work personally is much more around the psyche of everything. Yep. how players, you know, how certain things do have an impact in those respects. More specifically, a lot of your focus is on how to help your athletes in particular develop their decision-making ability. Where did that curiosity or that that line of, you know, thinking for you come from to you know, that you wanted to explore a little bit more of that? Because that's not all coaches certainly would consider themselves a necessarily developmental coach, but that is a large part of being a developmental coach and allowing for a space where players or athletes can help themselves in developing their decision-making aspects.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things that I got off into after a certain period of time of gaining some tools, I really started focusing on, okay, how to drive performance. Okay, how do you take an athlete and actually help them perform well? So there's one thing to teach them skills. There's one thing to train them up and get them physically ready to compete. But ultimately, where the rubber meets the road in sport is performance. And so we start kind of looking at performance as an art, you know, or some sort of some sort of craft. And I think the best performers in the world, there is performance talent, I believe. And so what are the things that drive that? And so I come into it from this place of objectivity, where I was exploring things and trying to understand things a little bit more scientifically. And one of the things that really helped me a lot was I ran into a statistician out of Australia. His name is Stuart Leong. And Stuart has a company called Shots to Hole. And he had been acquiring information about the way people play the game. And I asked him to help me out with a couple of players. And we took a kind of a deep dive off into some of their performance data. there'd been very few people that I think had taken it on at that point in time. And I found out some things that I didn't know. For example, I didn't really know what good was, right? So if you don't know what good is, you know, performance wise, then you can drive yourself crazy, or you can not hold yourself accountable. Those are your two choices. You know, it's hard to get it just right. And so once I kind of got a chance to get my head around what good was, I could actually start helping people make better decisions, right? Okay. So if you got to hit, for a tour player, for example, a tour player has to be able to hit the golf ball in the fairway off the tee about 70% of the time, right? And then from the fairway, they've got to knock it on the green about 70% of the time. If they miss a green, they've got to be able to chip the ball in two shots into the hole, get the golf ball up and down in about 70% of the time. And they have to take about 29 putts. And so those are the hard numbers that golf gives us. The variance in golf for the players at that level is about 5% of the distance. So what's good? Anywhere inside 5% of the distance would be a good shot. So at 100 yards, that would be 5 yards right and left. 200 yards, 10 yards right and left. And you can take that to meters or whatever measurement tool that you want. But that's the basic scale, right? So if I know that a player has to go kind of play at that level, first thing we can do is we can train to that level. We can help them identify, okay, either you're already good enough and we don't need to worry too much about it, or in spite of the fact that you think you're great at this, you still need to get better, right? And once you kind of can help identify those benchmarks, you can help people make decisions, right? So, and this 70% number keeps coming up. It's an interesting number for me, because if you poll the tour players, the really good ones, and you ask them about, you know, if they're getting ready to take on a shot out of the off the tee or out of the fairway towards some sort of target, you still get into discussion about two things. Okay, is it possible, first off, right? And the second thing, is it probable, right? So if you start looking from a possibility perspective, these players are so gifted that they're willing to take on things that are frightening. I mean, they're just very, very difficult. I mean, so they'll take on a shot that's you know, on a probability scale is maybe 1 or 2 or 3 out of 10, just because the possibility exists, right?
Sure.
So once you kind of get to where you can understand the difference between possibility and probability, you can help decision-making. All right. So for example, so the tour players, the best ones I've ever been around, the general rule that they use is if I'm getting ready to take this shot from where I'm standing to that target, I've got to get myself to a place where I feel like with the club I've chosen, the shot that I've chosen, I've got to be able to kind of get it up around 7 out of 10 before I make a decision on it. So they make their decisions a little bit conservative so that they can swing aggressively, right? So the 7 out of 10 rule on the tour is the basic rule that I've been around with the really good players. So they'll start with saying, okay, if I took 10 shots in this location, I've got to feel confident that I can get the ball into play 7 out of 10 times before I will go ahead and execute that shot.
Sure. And, you know, I just wanted a couple of things that are just popping through my head as you're talking through there. Now, first of all, is that assessment process. Now, you know, I can certainly in the sport that I'm in, working in football, obviously soccer, as you guys know, a lot more variables I think would be thrown into the equation, because it's obviously it's a contact sport and you've got an opposition, a live opposition. So I'm curious to know, you know, in the sport of golf, and I guess when it comes to working with an individual that's in some ways unopposed, how do you create those realistic pressures that they would have to put themselves through to maybe make a real fair assessment of whether something is possible and or probable?
Yeah, I think it's really, you know, if you give them that 70% rule, the reason I like that 7 out of 10 idea, and just back up one step, in most of the other sports, the environment's so dynamic that you don't have that opportunity, you know, to sit there and actually make a decision. A lot of times it's, you know, you have to train yourself to be able to see things and move and react to kind of what's happening in the environment. And golf is, while the environment does impact the way the players, you know, see and think, the ball is stationary, and you really have a lot more options in terms of having some an actual strategy about what's going to happen, right? Mm. So we start kind of looking at being able to try to take that on. The reason I like that 7 out of 10 rule, because it allows the player to be able to, in on a day when maybe they're not feeling great, 7 out of 10 might look different than on a day when they really feel like they're on top of their form, right? So let's say that they've hit some poor tee shots and they stand up on a tee and they're kind of looking out there and they're thinking, gosh, you know, 7 out of 10 today, not going to be a driver. It may be a 3-wood or a 5-wood or some other club, right? So it gives the player the opportunity to adapt based on the moment and how the emotional confidence and the confidence that they're bringing into that moment. So the one of the things that happens with the golfer is the coach is not there with them. They have to be able to do this by themselves. So you have to skill them up on how to think and how to work through these moments. And every now and then somebody will, you know, as long as they've got a strategy on how to do that, most of them are pretty willing to take it on.
Brilliant. You know, some of the things, again, I think as coaches, we're constantly challenged to look at ourselves and thinking, right, what are the values and what are the ideas that we're trying to push onto the athletes or the people that we work with. And for me, one of those things is I'm very much about that tactical side, you know, that psychological side, making decisions. You know, how in tune are we to what we're doing? And, people, you know, whenever I get asked the question of what type of coach you are, I often refer to myself as a coach of the why.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
I want the athlete to really understand the why behind what they're doing. I've gone away from where maybe in my early years I was much more about this is what I want to see, this is how I want it done. It's much more actually here's where I want you to get to. Let's work together to see the most efficient way of you as an individual getting there. And that might look different to the person over here and the person over there, which is absolutely fine with me. However, what we will do is we'll start to ask ourselves some questions about the process we're following so that we can get to a more efficient way of working. So I'm curious, you know, on that front, what are the types of questions that either, you know, firstly, maybe that you start asking of your athletes, and correct me if I'm wrong, but then in support of that, what are the types of questions that you want your athletes to start asking themselves?
Yeah, so I think ultimately, I think my goal with the athletes that I would get involved with is ultimately get them to a place of self-reliance where my role over time should change. So on the front end, it may be a lot more helping them develop skills and strategies and so on and so forth. And over time, they become more self-reliant where they can kind of take those things on, take some ownership of those things. And my role should change. And ultimately, my job is to coach myself out of a job at some point. I think that would be the ideal situation, you know, so. As far as tactics go and pure periodization, tactics has to do with kind of planning, goal setting, and strategy. So it's a fairly, you know, wide lane, but there are very, very specific things in that lane that need to be taken care of. So strategies on how to compete, how to train, how to recover, well, those are all things that we have to upskill these players on, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of goal setting, intention drives the truck. It really, if a player cannot get themselves clear on their intention, they're going to waffle. It's just the way it is. And most people, the big people that I've seen that have really hit high marks in golf are very, very intentional. So they're very goal driven. They know exactly what they're doing. They start with a very specific destination in mind. So, you know, that idea of intention and goal setting as it relates to the tactics, I think is super important. And then how do you organize the training to be able to support that? You know, how do you periodize that through the different phases of the year, from off season, preseason, end season, injuries? So that's really becomes kind of the as you get further along, and once the technical things are developed and the physicality is developed, right? And then you move off more into training mental strategies and also this idea of tactics, which is takes care of a lot of it. And a lot of my work with particularly with the players that I coach that are on the PGA Tour now is a lot of that. I mean, all of our technical projects that, you know, those are underway. It's not like we have to go and reinvent the wheel there every day. It's a, we know what we're doing technically. Each player has their own blueprint. You know, mentally that we've got things in place. They got their gym programs in place. So the further you get down this road, it becomes a lot more about this tactical training, and the role that I provide, it becomes much more tactical by nature.
Definitely. And I think, you know, just in the there, then obviously, you know, I guess a model that we use in my sport is, you know, is the idea of the four corners. You've got the technical, tactical element, which is one area, and you've got the psychological, you've got the social, and then you've got the physical aspects. Now, if there is a model in your sport, and if, you know, is there one?
There's, you know, the sport doesn't have one. I think each coach would probably have their own model. I mean, I've been following Isvan Bali's work for a long, long time. He's kind of become a good friend of mine. And so I like the simplicity of the physical, the technical, physical, mental, and the mental picks up the social in my mind.
Yeah, definitely.
And then the final part is the tactics. And so I periodize around those four things. The mental part of it can also, you know, it's just really super important to get right and making sure that they have the right culture. And you know, it's interesting. One of the things that I've kind of gotten off into and become very interested in is this idea of culture in sport. So in team sport, it's pretty easy to set the culture. The head coach decides, okay, these are the values that we're going to focus on, and then we're going to, you know, pay attention to. But in individual sport, there's, you know, you don't have teammates. And so part of it is making sure that each player has time to kind of sit down and actually work through developing their culture, their warrior culture. How are you going to be when it comes time to compete, or when it matters most? And so I've spent quite a bit of time the past 4 or 5 years making sure that I get that done early, making sure that they understand what their own personal culture is. And then everybody that kind of joins their team becomes, you know, read into to the values. For example, we're going to be fearless, focused, calm, decisive, whatever those elements are, and make sure that everybody on board that gets onboarded understands, okay, when you step into this space with this athlete, this is who we are. Right. So,
and just to kind of on that, you know, you talked there about the subtle difference, or the major differences rather, between obviously golf being an individual sport and, you know, the other sports that, you know, are generally team sports. And I'm interested in, obviously, from the perspective of a coach who's working largely with individuals, how often do you, I guess, put those two, put more than one individual together and have them training on this, you know, side by side? And more specifically, I'm really keen to know what some of the, I guess, strategies are around how you work with an individual. Because now what's becoming more and more prominent, certainly in my sport, is the idea of pulling players out or athletes out and creating individual development programs for them, supporting them as individuals. And yeah, I'd be keen to know a little bit more about what you're talking about there, in the sense of setting a personal culture. Obviously, you're right, largely, you know, where the head coach is present, they will be setting that, you know, that overall team environment culture. But I think it's a very important aspect in terms of, yes, we've got the overall arching team culture, but still within that, we've got so many subtle differences, or maybe differences between the individuals within it. So, yeah, I'm curious to find out what are some of the strategies that you would consider applying in devising or identifying what that culture should look like.
Well, I think that we start with the idea that when the best sporting culture in the world, arguably, would be the New Zealand All Blacks. If you look at their record over time, wins versus the amount of matches played, they're in their own league, right? And if you take a little kind of a deep dive off into kind of how they roll, they don't really focus on, you know, there's never any decision about, okay, at the end of the game, we're going to have the most valuable player. There's not going to be a most valuable player at the end of the week or the year. They say, we simply sit down at the end of practice or at the end of a game or the season, and we identify people that on the team that actually embodied some of the values that we have. So for example, we say, okay, you know, today I want to acknowledge Yasser for his selflessness. And this is in this moment, we all saw it. That's exactly what it looks like. Thank you for your contribution to our team. All right. So all of a sudden, this thing becomes so much bigger than, you know, somebody trying to win the game ball or or have the, you know, have the, you know, take the last shot on goal and win the game, or hole a putt, you know. So in team sports, that's, it's, you know, you can actually build that up, right? And so it's, so culture basically is, okay, you know, how do we do things when it matters most? Mm-hmm. Right? This is the way we do things, and how are we going to do it when it matters most? If you can answer those two questions, you can build culture. Mm-hmm. I learned that from Jerry Lynch, who I think is one of the brightest guys on the planet. I love Jerry, and he's helped me. He was a guy that helped me learn how to take it from team sport into an individual sport, because I had no idea. You know, my theme and the idea of having culture even on my radar as a coach was not even on, you know, it was probably, I innately understood it, but I had no idea cognitively how to try to approach it and try to help coach people through it. So and he basically helped teach me how to do it. And we took a couple of players that I was working with. I started with myself and my own personal culture and kind of worked on it to kind of get a feel for it. I took a couple of players on and had some success with it. And so I began to believe that, okay, this moves the needle. This helps players. And so we start with the idea that we're going to have a warrior culture, because when you go to compete, you know, when you're home, you need to be a compassionate, you know, warm, big hearted human being. But when you go to compete, you're off to war. And so, you know, the best warriors, and what does warrior culture mean? Well, it means that you have to step in, you have to bring certain attributes or certain qualities to your craft, to your training, to your preparation, to your competition. And so it's just the matter of actually sitting the athletes down, presenting this as a concept, and helping them define their own culture. Let them define it. You just take them through an exercise and say, okay, what are the qualities that you think you need to bring to these moments, right? And let them construct their own culture. And so, because at that point in time, it resonates with their spirit. It's not going to be something that I've artificially, you know, developed and then try to superimpose on somebody. I think each person has to find that in their spirit, in terms of, okay, this resonates with me. Because when it comes push to shove, and you're out there by yourself, you know, in one of those big moments, you got to be able to lean on yourself. You got to know that I'm wired up for this. I've done the preparation. I'm ready to go.
Mm. Oh, definitely. And I totally agree with that. I think you have to have that shifted mindset that of competition. Now, I want to now bring it back to obviously the idea of the decision making aspect of things.
Right.
How much of that is then drawn out of that mindset? And how do you then bridge the gap to get help? You help these players shift their mindset to a point of actually we need to start being a bit, you know, in some ways have a bit more of a growth mindset here and really start to assess things on a wider scale and not be told tunnel visioned on the what, but more about the why and the when.
Yeah, I think, you know, you start kind of, I'll just give you a little story about, you know, how this kind of plays out. So we're talking about decision-making. So, in the 2000s, run up to the 2016 Olympics, I was coaching a Russian woman by the name of Maria Burchanova. Maria was she was from Russia. She was playing on the Ladies European Tour, and she was probably one of the biggest underachievers I've ever seen. I mean, technically, she was so good. I mean, she was almost staggering to watch. I mean, all of her skills looked great, but her performances never really kind of matched up to that. So it was always this question, you know, why couldn't Maria, you know, get herself organized? And so we started working together, and this is about the time I'd met Jerry Lynch, and he had been taking me through some things. And so anyway, I got started with Maria and helped her with her technical game, and she got better and started playing, having some nice results in Europe, and decided she wanted to come to the States and start playing here on the women's tour here. So this is all in the run up to the 2016 Olympics, right? So she was in and out of training. She would go back and play in Europe. She would play a few events here. And about 8 or 9 weeks before the Olympics, she rolls into my office and she goes, I could tell by the look on her face that something's not right. I mean, and she's normally kind of cheerful and bubbly. So I close the door, I sit down and said, hey, what's going on? You seem like you're upset about something. She goes, Kevin, she goes, I've got these Olympics coming up and I'm just scared to death. I'm like, scared to death? I mean, it's the Olympics. I mean, you know, it's the first time people play golf in the Olympics in 100 years. It's going to be a blast. Are you kidding me? She goes, yeah, but you don't understand. I said, well, enlighten me, please tell me what's going on. So she says, well, you know, in Russia, I've had a lot of friends from other sports that have gone to the Olympics and they've gone to and competed and done well. And they come back and there's all sorts of opportunities for them. I mean, there's there's business opportunities that pop up and all these different things that happen, and all, you know, it's just an unbelievably incredible thing to kind of watch somebody go through that. She goes, I've also seen people go to the Olympics and fail and come back to Russia, and it's not good. She goes, and it's not good for the person, for their family, opportunities. And she goes, I'm just concerned that I'm going to go to Rio and I'm going to struggle. And then he's saying, and I can't afford to do that. She goes, I almost think I want to just not go. I said, no, you got to go. So I said, well, what if we could kind of, let's sit down and kind of build you a warrior culture so that when you show up, that you're going to bring your best, that you're going to be ready and be prepared. So I said, you're going to compete. You're going to be a warrior. You're not going to go in there and get run over. All right. So everybody at the Olympics that does well, complete warrior. Right. I said, so what qualities do you want to kind of bring to the table down there to have a good
support for this podcast? And the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I go to Olympics. And she says, well, I got to be decisive. I get in those moments and I just get to where I can't make a decision. And I said, okay, all right. So we need to figure out, making sure we have a strategy for that. And I said, what else? She goes, I need to be fearless. I cannot be afraid of this. I said, yeah, I agree with that. So she goes, I need to be present. She goes, I get way ahead or way behind myself. I said, okay, what else? She goes, I need to be calm. All right. So, I think there was one other one. I can't remember exactly what it was. So anyway, we decided, okay, these are the qualities that we have to be mindful of. We have to train. You have to be ready so that when that moment comes and you've got to put the ball on the ground, you've got to hit it and get after it at the Olympics, you're bringing all the right qualities to that moment. So we had to put together just a card with those words on it. We had her come up with a picture of herself that reminded her of a warrior. She had a picture of herself standing by her golf bag that she'd been professionally shot, and she's standing there with her glasses on and looked complete warrior. It was a great photograph. So she had this card. On one side was a photograph of her being with the warrior pose, and the other side were these words. Right. So every day when she got here, I said, okay, this is how this works. When you get here to practice, and when you get to the golf course, any place in the world, when that trunk slams, you're the warrior. That's it. Game on. I said, if you ever turn around and the warrior's not there, you take your hat off, you put it back on, and you're the warrior. You can pull it together that quick. Yeah. So we got her involved, her caddy involved. Everybody was, we've got this warrior culture thing kind of going together. So we talked in terms of her decision making by using the 70% rule that I was telling you about. We talked to her about having some ideas in preparation to be able to kind of figure out, how to tactically move the golf ball around the golf course strategically and how they could prepare and get that done. So they had two projects when they left here, this course management thing to be able to understand the course and the 70% rule. Those are the two things. And I said, as far as your decisiveness goes, it's sticking to your guns on your game plan. And the second part is going to be being able to kind of be adaptive and use that 70% rule as you move from moment to moment. All right, so those were the decision-making strategies that we set in place to be decisive. You just do that; that makes you decisive. Okay. So anyway, she goes down to Rio and she's hanging around even par, which is puts her in about the middle of the pack after for 3 days. In the last round of the Olympics, she shoots 62. Now, 62 is 10 under par. It's and it was the lowest score that was shot by either a male or a female at the Olympics. So now, and she barely misses a medal. I think she finishes fourth or fifth. And so now she leaves the Olympics as being the world record holder for score in the Olympics, right? And she's had this incredible experience. So she flies back to Europe, and I don't see her for a couple of weeks and give her a couple, you know. So I said, well, I'm going to give her a call and see what she's doing. So I call her, I don't hear back from her. About a week later, she finally calls back. I said, hey, Maria, what's going on? She goes, oh yeah. She goes, it's been going great. I was just, you know, just trying to recover from the Olympics. It's been such a kind of whirlwind for me. And, you know, came back and all sorts of really cool things. I said, well, that's great. I said, when am I going to see you again? She goes, well, I was going to call you about that. I said, what's that? She goes, I think I'm going to retire. I'm like, you can do what? She goes, I think I'm going to retire. I said, why on earth would you retire? You just got your golf game ramped back up and you shot 62 at the Olympics. And she goes, remember that story I told you about the good and bad of the Olympics in Russia for me? She goes, I came back and I've been there. I'm sitting here on my desk looking at about $500,000 worth of contracts. And for me right now, I can't not take that. It would cost me money to play golf based on these opportunities that have been presented to me business-wise. Mm. So, you know, the cool thing about that story is, you know, here's a girl that was a woman that was getting ready to go to the Olympics, scared to death, technically could handle it, but her headspace was not great, right? Sit down, we talk about developing the culture. You know, one of them was decision-making, gave her two strategies and said, okay, this is it. Doesn't have to be complicated. You just have to do this, be decisive. You use your 70% rule and you stick to your game plan. Got it? Okay, I can do that. Okay. So I think, you know, what, and so she goes, does, you know, takes this culture into this big, massive moment for her, and it changes her life, you know? And so I do think that the strategies that we use for decision-making need to be practical. I think they need to be things that people can do simply, and it can't be too big. And the reason I say that is because if you pile complex decision-making strategies on top of people and they're trying to operate in a complicated environment, the weight of all that becomes too much. So the strategies have to be simple, and they have to be only one or two. You can't give them a long laundry list of saying, oh, this, you know, to be decisive or, you know, make a great decision, I need to do seven or eight things. So.
No, I feel you on that one. I think the question I would throw back at you then is, if they're only having a limited amount of decisions to make, are we then potentially limiting the potential amount of outcomes there could be?
Well, I think it's hopefully just to keep them on track, right? Mm. So it has to do mostly with, let's see, I lost it. To be coming back on here. So sorry about that. I think that part of our job as coaches is not to worry too much about all the possible outcomes, but try to kind of get something that somebody can use practically in the competitive environment, right? Yeah, I mean, there's going to be every now and then this black swan, like a coronavirus is going to come along that you're not going to see, right? It's going to come out of a funny spot and you're going to be blindfolded and you're just going to, you're going to get run over. It happens a lot. But as coaches, we know the majority of the situations can be handled by a couple of these basic things. Mm. At the end of a competition, you talked about kind of the backside of that, kind of the debriefing. You know, we always ask three questions. Okay, what did I do well? What needs work? And what's the plan? Right. That's the only three questions we ask ever. You know, as it relates to kind of in that debriefing after an event or after a season or some sort of completion. Right. So if the strategies that we've been using are effective, right. So then the athlete can say, did well, my decision making was good. Okay. If they said it wasn't well, okay, well, tell me about that. What's happening? So we can talk about that, refine it, fine tune it, and then in the next cycle we can try to do that differently or better or whatever requires. So I do think it's, you know, having a debriefing process that allows you to say, okay, you know, how does the athlete perceive, you know, the way they handle it, how's the coach perceive the way they handle it, come to agreement that, okay, yeah, we think it was okay, or we think it was not okay, or we need to have a discussion about it. So it's, you know, did well. Okay. If it did well, then no drama, right? If it didn't do well, okay, then it needs work, right? If it needs work, then what's the plan? And so having that debriefing on the back side of that will should help you fine tune anything that's required that allows it, that might be adaptive for a certain, you know, allows it to be adaptive and some of these strategies can kind of move and they can grow and kind of move along as needed to, you know, based on the challenge that the athletes are encountering.
No, definitely. I think, you know, that process there, but I'm curious, and you know, that's that debriefing process, how important is it that it's not just post activity, but also during activity?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's interesting when we start kind of looking at progress, you know, we always think about progress as being some sort of kind of linear, you know, some sort of linear line. The truth of the matter is it's like this, you know, it's never a straight line, right? And the second thing is that my thought about it is it's like you're rolling a wheel.
Yeah.
Right? And the wheel is the process. And the wheel is a process. And so you stay in the process. It's a little circular process, right? And you're rolling along and you just want the general pitch of this slope, not only one given day, but generally to kind of be ticking upward, right? And so if you have good benchmarks and metrics about performance and you have the right technical things in place and the right physicality in place and the right mental strategies in place, and you're asking the right questions, you should be able to, you know, moving somebody up that slope is something you do. Now, it's not easy. It takes a lot of work to stay in that process. I mean, everybody wants to have some sort of process you can automate. Well, there's no automation. You've got to just be with it. You've got to be with them. You got to be with the athlete. You got to be present. You got to, you know, use your instincts, use your brain. You got to use your metrics. You got to use all your tools. Right. And it's never the same set of tools that need two athletes, although the process is almost identical.
Mm, mm. And obviously on that journey, then how important is it for you then that it's something you touched on earlier, you want your athletes to become self-reliant, almost, you know, I think the phrase you use was you want to coach yourself out of a job essentially. Now, I've got a fairly similar view in the way I work, and you know, I like to think of it more as I want to coach my athletes to be, you know, initially I used to think it was to become independent, but actually independent suggests that whilst I guess they have maybe potentially the confidence and the, you know, the bravery to go ahead and make decisions themselves, they may be limited to only their way of thinking. So I like to think of it more of a path to interdependence, where they can kind of, like, you know, technically and tactically, they are competent and they're inept in making decisions. However, so socially, they, you know, they still feel confident and, you know, are willing to, I guess, look elsewhere for the answers too.
Sure.
You know, for me, a large part of that process is challenge the place to look at everything they're doing, whether that be, you know, the way they prepare, the way they actually perform an action, and looking at the finer details. So I'm quite fixated now on the finer details of everything, you know, from the mechanics, the motions, and really. You know, we hear these stories all the time about maybe great athletes don't always become great coaches. You know, and my theory is how it's probably down to how much they're in tune with what they're actually doing. We hear this word, instincts, brought around all the time, and say, you know, this athlete was amazing and how instinctive they were. But, you know, instincts just suggest it's just a reaction. It's not, there's no like thought process going on. What are your thoughts on that in terms of an athlete? Is that something that you look to kind of instill within your athletes in terms of getting to become more in tune or attuned with what they're actually doing and actually paying attention to how they feel? And what are some of the ways in which you go about doing that, if that is the case?
I think that, you know, I loved your word interdependence, and I think that's probably what we actually kind of look for. The difference between maybe, you know, football and where the players are actually a member of a team, and golf is that in a team, they're under contract and you can fire them, right? In golf, I'm the one who gets fired. Okay, right. So I have to be thinking about really trying to empower this athlete and give them what they need. And with the full understanding that once they've learned everything that they're going to learn from me, it's okay for them to go on and seek other things, right? So I've been part of their discovery, a part of their process. And so it's a little bit different. The athletes that we coach aren't under ownership or they're not under contract. So my job is to try to spend enough time where I actually truly understand the athlete, help them, you know, develop a pathway that lets them go where they're trying to go. Right. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the athletes aren't clear on where they're trying to go. So part of that is, you know, might be calling them out and saying, hey, listen, I hear what you're saying. You want to be on the tour, but you need to think this out a little bit deeper. Okay. You need to be 20th in the world, 50th in the world, 100th in the world, because each one of those levels is going to be a different discussion. Right. So to your point, once you can kind of figure out the destination where we're trying to kind of get to, you can mash out the details and you can get into some pretty, you know, you can really chunk it down to some very, you know, small things. I think the smallness of all that is really good for coaches to understand. I think the thing that we want to try to be careful with our athletes is not to try to overload them, and try to kind of create, try to help them increase their IQ in their sport, increase their competence and their belief in themselves, and try to simplify it down so that when they step in the environment to go out and compete, they can focus more on the environment, less on kind of all the things that float around their head.
Definitely. And one of the things that, you know, you touched on there right at the start of that is that, yes, golf is an individual sport. You know, a sport that I'm in, football, is one where you are part of a team and you can be let go of. And I guess one of the things that kind of popped in my head as you were talking is, do you face challenges in the sense of, no, I'm trying to draw a comparison here, in that we might have a player on our team, as an example, that might play in a certain position, but we might feel they're better suited to something else.
Yeah.
I guess the comparison in your sport might be the way in which they're performing at this point in time. A particular technique might be more efficient, their playing style. They might be less aggressive in some ways, and you might want to shift that to something different. Do you find resistance at that sort of thing at times? And, you know, because I'm coming back to what you said about where they want to go with it.
Right.
They've got a vision. They've got an idea. They want to go this direction and they want to do it in this way because that's what they feel is best for them. But in some cases, that what they feel could be a more of a want rather than a need.
Right. Yeah. I think that you start kind of looking at trying to help steer athletes along. I mean, it starts with just having a clear intention of where they want to go. The great thing that we have in golf is that once we can kind of figure out, get them to get committed to, okay, let's say I want to be 10th in the world, right? Once they say that, we can benchmark it. I can figure out exactly what that means in terms of shots, their shots off the tee box, their approach shots, their shots around the green, and how many shots on the green it's going to require to take. And then we can actually measure those benchmarks versus their performance data. And we can say, okay, you know, you want to be this guy, right? You're in this area, you're pretty good, but you need to get this much better over here, right? So we can actually use data to help them understand. And then once the data's on the table, it's like, okay, you know, you just told me you want to be this top 10 guy, okay? So I don't want to hear that you don't like about what the data says. I don't want to hear what that you don't want to. If you want to do this, we've got to buckle down. We've got to get training, and we've got to figure out how to close these gaps down, right? And so. So I do use data that way to bridge this delta between, you know, where they are and where they want to be, right? And most of the coaching, and I think you would probably agree with this, is just trying to, it's awareness training. It's trying to help them become aware of the things they need to become aware of, right? To achieve whatever they want to achieve. Mm. Most of them have the desire. Most of them have the tools by the time that we get our hands on them. And so, you know, if you've got desire and tools, then the only thing that you need is you need to, you know, to be aware of the right things to be able to focus your attention on to get to where you want to go. And if you can do that consistently over time, you'll arrive.
Definitely. And just on that, then, you know, I'm curious, you know, so one of the things I do is, you know, as part of my role is I also work in coach education. So I deliver coaching courses. And, you know, the questions I always try to write is trying to really, you know, provoke thought and curiosity within the people on the course. And certainly in the sport of football, I've seen that over the last few years, particularly because of the shift, and I referred to the model earlier about four corners and looking at those things, the model seems to have shifted a lot more around a blended approach, which I think is fantastic. However, I think it does leave room for people to maybe shy slightly away from what the sport is really about, and that's that technical and tactical stuff. Now, I'm not sure if you face similar challenges in your sport in particular, but I'm curious to know then, you know, we're really talking about trying to align athletes' vision or trying to align their attention to what they're actually doing, how it's being done, and the process within that. So would it be fair to say, you know, certainly from your sport, I know I definitely feel this is the case in mine, that if you're not really, if you don't really have a true underpinning of some of that technical stuff, then more technical than tactical, then you're not really well equipped enough to actually then shift their attention to those things. And
yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Focusing on. So, I mean, I guess the question really is what are some of the processes that you go through, I guess, as a coach to ensure that you're on the right lines in terms of the technical aspects?
Yeah, so, I mean, golf is by nature a very technical sport. I mean, it's way up there in terms of the complex, you know, to complex motor skills. And so, and a lot of the study and a lot of the information that gets thrown around in our business is thrown and directed towards that. And there's, I mean, with one of the things that's happened in the past probably 15 or 20 years is we've suddenly been inundated with technology. I mean, we've got launch monitors and force plates and, you know, stuff that people have been using in other sports. We didn't see any of that stuff until, you know, 20 years ago. I mean, the first time I saw a video camera and, you know, got seen by a swing was probably about 20 years ago. So I think that, you know, and so what that does is everybody initially falls in love with the technology, right? They're so excited about the new technology and it becomes so objective that people, the coaches actually fall in love with the objectivity. At the end of the day, what you want is a coach that's competent, somebody that can actually help you, right? Somebody that knows how to move the needle. And so as it relates to competence as a coach, you have to, in my world, you have to, you know, I focus on making sure that I can help people technically. All right. I've got a strong enough background in all the disciplines that we require, the anatomy and physiology, the biomechanics, the movement, the skill acquisition stuff. I've got to have all that because that's part of what I'm doing. And to your point, if you're asking somebody to kind of go out and compete in an environment and they don't have the skill in, no mental strategies or tactical strategies are going to help them. Okay. I mean, they're just not good enough. Right. So part of it is being able to assess that and say, okay, as I'm looking at this, I've got a clear enough eye and understanding of this to say, okay, this should be good enough. Okay. And if it's not good enough, then we can start kind of pursuing that next set of questions. The way I love to do that is to not, there's a lot of ways people do it, but I've got my favorite way to do it is to give, once we can get an idea of what the intention is and what the benchmarks are, and we determine that, everybody knows what it is. I like to set a set of tasks up for the athlete to go take on. And I watch. And here's it. So, because this, if you're going to accomplish this task, it has to be done at this level to translate into what you're wanting to do on the golf course. So I give them a set of tasks and I watch them. Right. And I say, okay, here's the task. Okay. We're going to hit 20 putts inside of 12 feet and you got to make 12 of them. Okay, here we go. Have a go. I'll set the putts up. You hole them and we'll count them. Right. And so let them have a go. And if they scored, 13 or 14, then okay. You've clearly proven to me that you're good enough, right? And
I want to kind of really drill into this point where my question really came from as well, is that I come across so many cool coaches, not just in football, just in general, different sports who I consider to be more facilitators or even commentators. Yeah. They're very much, I want you to do this, I want you to do that, but they don't quite understand that if an athlete or a player isn't able to perform the action, even if not necessarily achieve the outcome, shall we say, and complete that task, because of their, in some cases, lack of understanding of the actual technical aspect of it, and not to say that it hasn't done it one particular way, but a way, a baseline or a structure or a platform to work from, that they can never then really navigate to themselves on that process as to where they need to kind of step in, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right. I mean, ultimately, the question we ask is, what we really look for is coaching, is the athlete competent? Can they compete in the environment and perform at the levels required for them to be successful, right? So if we're focusing on competence, then there's two ways we can assess competence. One is through their performance data. Okay, how do they perform under the pump, right? Mm-hmm. If they're performing well under the pump and their technique is not great, then they've still proven to me that they're okay. I mean, Jim Furyk is a guy in golf who's technically you would look at and you go, you know, you can't believe that the guy's even on tour. He was one of the best players of his era because he was competent, right? And if you're an unskilled coach, the danger is see somebody like that walks in their office who's already competent, mm-hmm. and just tries to make a whole bunch of changes that aren't necessary, and they ruin athletes, right? So I think the first thing you have to do is test for competence. Is the athlete competent? If they're competent, they're not going to hurt themselves. Then my job is to try to learn and understand how they do that and try to support that, right? Mm-hmm. If they can't do it for some reason, then that's when I lean in, okay? And I can lean in a lot of different ways. It could be through equipment, through technology, through technique, through nutrition, through a million different ways you can lean in to try to help, right? And if I'm developing somebody, then I've got my own ideas and I will steer people. If I've got a young kid, a 12-year-old kid that's walked in my office that wants to kind of get on this long-term developmental pathway, then I'll develop based on the principles that I think are probably going to give them the best chance to succeed, you know? So it's a little bit different with each level of athlete, but to your point, I love what you were saying. And that is that you have to be, you know, when you're trying to kind of make that decision, you have to be really careful, particularly with world-class athletes, because you could ruin them. You can do more harm than good, you know, if you're not careful.
100%. You know, I'm just interested now, obviously, as we start to wind down, you know, just coming back to the idea of that decision-making, how to help athletes improve their decision-making. If you could just take us through some of your how-to steps and what you'd consider as, an important part of that strategy and process.
Yeah, I think ultimately it starts with helping educate them, you know, helping them become more, increase their IQ about what it is that they're actually dealing with, right? So a lot of teams, people make bad decisions out of one or two reasons, either arrogance or ignorance. There's no other reason people that make poor decisions, right? So it's either, I understand the risk reward, but I'm going to be bullheaded. I'm going to take it on anyway. And if I fail, okay, well, that's on you, right? And then, but if it's ignorance, they just don't know, then our job is to help fill in the gaps, right? Mm-hmm. So the athletes that are acting in an arrogant manner, we need to help them say, hey, listen, I hear what you're saying. I know how good you are, but you know something? That's a zero sum game for you. It's not going to, you know, you need to rethink this. Okay. Let's sit down and talk about it. I'll tell you where I want you to kind of take it on. I'm not saying you do it every time. If one out of every 20 times you still want to kind of take that thing on and take that arrogant approach, I'm happy with that. But your wellness and your well-being going forward and your survival in this sport is not going to be okay unless you can get your head around this. Mm-hmm. And then if I've got somebody who's ignorant, ignorance not being a bad word. It just means that they don't have the knowledge or the understanding or the awareness to be able to understand what it is they're trying to decide on. Right. So it's really trying to figure out which side of the spectrum the athletes are coming from and try to help them either rein them back and help, you know, help them say, okay, or fill in the gaps. And so it's always that, you know, it's funny. I always start my assessment with an athlete with a fresh piece of paper, because I don't want to have to think that I've got some sort of formula that I'm going to stuff them into. So I want to find out about what their processes are, you know, their decision-making processes and try to understand, do those align with their intention, you know, and is there attention on their intention that allows that to kind of to fuel the work that's required for them to be able to get to where they want to go. So I think you're always dealing with a population of one. And I think in team sports, it's even more important, because I think it would be very easy to try to stuff everybody in a box, but you're actually dealing with, you know, all these different kids with they're all different. So you have to, each one of them has to have to some extent their own program. And that requires a coach like you or me to sit down and get to know them and try to find out what they do well, what they don't do well, where those gaps are that we can fill in.
Brilliant. Well, look, Kevin, it's been really, it's been a pleasure for me to have this conversation with this evening. I've certainly taken a lot from it myself, and, you know, just further clarified some of the thoughts I've had in my head over the way I work and, you know, in the environments I work in. So I just want to thank you again for your time. I'm sure the listeners have found it as enjoyable as I have. Just on the final note, you know, if there is any listeners or viewers out there that would like to get in touch with you, maybe discuss some of the things that we've touched on in this conversation or beyond, Is there somewhere they can do that?
Yeah, they can find me on LinkedIn. I've got a site there, and I've also got I've also got an Instagram account. It's Kevin Kirk Golf. So you can hit me up there if you want to have another way. And those are probably the simplest ways to do it. And instead of trying to have an account, go through the old fashioned way of trying to track me down with phone or, you know, emails or whatever. So those are probably the two simplest way to do it. And and just before we stop, I really want to kind of thank you for inviting me on to your show. I love talking to coaches. Okay. And I really even more enjoy talking to coaches from other sports, because I think the growth for all of us is in the cross-pollination, where we have a chance to kind of get coaches from other areas to kind of, to where we compare notes and talk about things. Mm-hmm. Cause I always, all the big growth that I've had in my sport, the people in my sport, we all know the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always that opportunity to talk to somebody from an outside my sport or outside my domain, where I can cross-pollinate a little bit, that I pick up the ideas that help me grow. So I want to thank you for your time today. You've impacted my life in a really positive manner. And so I want to thank you for that.
My pleasure was mine. Again, look, thank you again, Kevin. It's been a wonderful discussion. I wish you all the joys and success in your career now. And, you know, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year for you too as well.
All right, mate, you too. All you guys be safe over there, and I'm sure we'll be in touch soon.
Definitely. Take care, Kevin.
Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent, and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at The Coaches Network or on Twitter at The Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.